Welcome to Damn Good Movie Memories with your host, Brian Davis. This podcast is the cure for your long commute and super boring workday.
My friends, I'm not given to wild, unsupported statements. And I tell you that we must evacuate this planet immediately.
Jor-El, be reasonable.
Once there was a civilization, much like ours, but with a greater intelligence, greater powers, and a greater capacity for good. Tragic moment, that world was destroyed. But there was one survivor.
Now, wouldn't that beat all get out?
Because of the wisdom and compassion of Jor-El, because he knew the human race had the capacity for goodness, he sent us his only son. His name is Kal-El. He will call himself Clark Kent. But the world will know him as Superman. This year, Superman brings you the gift of flight. Superman, the movie.
Hey there, it's Brian Davis, and for this week's episode, we're going to cover the movie Superman, the movie, the original from 1978. The studio was Warner Brothers. Release date was December 15th, 1978. The running time, 143 minutes. Now, this was the original release runtime. We'll get into all the different versions in a bit. The rating was PG. The budget was $55 million. It was the most expensive film made at the time. But the box office took in a whopping $134 million. It was the second-ranked movie of 1978. That would be the equivalent of $608 million today. Roger Ebert at that time loved it, gave it 4 out of 4 stars. Here's his review. Superman is a pure delight, a wondrous combination of all the old-fashioned things we never really get tired of. Adventure and romance, heroes and villains, earth-shaking special effects, and you know what else? Wit. That surprised me more than anything, that this big budget epic, which was a half decade making in its way to the screen, would turn out to have an intelligent sense of humor about itself. The wit, to be sure, is a little slow in revealing itself. The film's opening scenes combine great intergalactic special effects with ponderous acting and dialogue, most of it from Marlon Brando, who, as Superman's father, sends the kid to Earth in a spaceship that barely survives the destruction of the planet Krypton. The audience will find itself pleasantly surprised and taken a little off guard. The movie's tremendously exciting in a comic book sort of way. Kids will go ape for it, but at the same time, it has a sly sophistication, a kidding insight into the material that makes it, amazingly, a refreshingly offbeat comedy. Most of the humor centers on, of course, around one of the central icons of American popular culture, Superman, who, and I quote from our common memory of hundreds of comic books and radio and TV shows, and his dual identity as Clark Kent and a mild-mannered reporter for the Daily Planet, the producers held a worldwide talent search for an actor to play Superman. And although talent searches are usually 100% horse feathers, this time, for once, they actually found the right guy. He is Christopher Reeve. He looks like the Superman in the comic books, a fate I would not wish on anybody. But he's also an engaging actor, open and funny in his big love scene with Lois Lane, and then correctly awesome in his showdown with the arch-villain Lex Luthor. Reeves sells the role. Wrong casting here would have sunk everything. And there would have been a lot to sink. Superman may have been expensive, all right, but the money's there on the screen. The screenplay was obviously written without the slightest concern for how much it might cost. The movie works so well because of its wit and its special effects. A word more about each. The movie begins with the tremendous advantage that almost everyone in the audience knows the Superman saga from youth. There aren't a lot of explanations needed. That's brilliantly demonstrated in the first scene where Superman tries to change in a phone booth. Christopher Reeve can be allowed to smile to permit himself a double entendre to kid himself. And then the special effects. They're as good in their way as any you've seen, and they come thick and fast. When the screenplay calls for Lex Luthor to create an earthquake and for Superman to try to stop it, the movie doesn't give us a falling bridge or two. It gives us the San Andreas Fault cracking open. No half measures for Superman. The movie is, in fact, a triumph of imagination over both the difficulties of technology and the inhibitions of money. Superman wasn't easy to bring to screen, but the filmmakers kept it until they had it right. And that's the end of Ebert's review. So this era of Superman is still my favorite, and not just because I grew up with it. Christopher Reeve really was the perfect Superman, as Ebert said. He looked the part and played both the Superman and Clark Kent roles with ease. Now I think, though I've been changing lately, I still prefer Superman 2 slightly over the first movie, mostly because of the Krypton villains in the second movie. And even though Ebert made a good point, the first movie still gets somewhat bogged down by having to get the origin story out of the way. But it's a minor gripe. Look, the importance of the first movie really sent the blueprint for every other super movie that came after it. So definitely not dogging the first movie at all. I think it's absolutely brilliant. All right, let's get into the making of the film. So the origins of the film adaptation goes back to 1974, when Ilya Salkin and his father Alexander, along with their business partner Pierre Spengler, bought the film rights to Superman from DC Comics. Now what's interesting is that Warner Brothers actually owned DC Comics and could have made a film version of Superman anytime they wanted. But, as crazy as it seems now, comic book adaptations weren't considered marketable back in the 1970s. And if you think about it, the only major superhero movie to be released prior to Superman was the 1966 Batman movie based on the TV show. And actually, that's another reason why no other superhero film was made at the time, because the 1966 Batman film was considered campy. The producing trio came to an agreement with Warner Brothers to do a negative pickup deal. This means that the independent producers essentially do everything needed to make the film. Finance, casting, everything. Once the film is completed, the studio would then purchase the film from the filmmakers and distribute the film. The profits would then be split between the two parties. Now, the reason this type of deal was done at times back in the day was usually due to the major studio not likely having faith in the original idea of the film, and it was up to the independent filmmaker to put their own money where their idea was. And if the film turned out well, it would be a win-win for both parties. And the major studio doesn't have to take the initial risk of financing the film. The producers knew if they wanted Superman to be the epic they envisioned, they needed people with bankable names. The first hire was writer Mario Puzo. And he had written the novel and the screenplay, of course, for The Godfather. Having Puzo attached to the project gave the producers some name power to help raise financing for the film. And similar to The Godfather, Superman was to have two stories written simultaneously, and the original film and its sequel would also be filmed together. While having Puzo helped with the financing, it was the signing of Marlon Brando to the project that gave Superman legitimate blockbuster film potential. Brando's contract was one of the highest deals ever given to an actor at the time. He was to receive almost $4 million for only 2 weeks of shooting, plus points on the film. This was an enormous sum for 1977. It was like $20 million today. Brando would pay Superman's father on Krypton, Jor-El. After signing Brando, the next big name to come on board was Gene Hackman to play Lex Luthor. Now, Hackman was reluctant to play the role at first, as he felt his credibility as a serious actor would be tarnished. He only thought of the film as a cartoon, but ultimately decided he could turn the character into something he could be proud of. So now that you had two huge stars on board, the producers needed a director. The first hire was British director Guy Hamilton. He was known for his work on the James Bond movies like Goldfinger, Diamonds Are Forever, Live and Let Die, and The Man with the Golden Gun. Superman was going to be shot in Italy. However, the lira, of course that's Italy's currency, well, that went up, and the English pound dropped, and the producers decided to move the production to England, which would save millions of dollars. However, back in the 1960s and 70s, tax issues plagued the very wealthy earners in England. And often stars would leave their home country to avoid paying ridiculously high tax rates, and they were called tax exiles. Because of this, Hamilton was only allowed to be in England for 30 days. And this is where Superman was going to be filmed. Suffice to say, this wouldn't work for the producers of the film. So with Hamilton no longer the director, the producers hired director Richard Donner after seeing the 1976 hit horror film The Omen, which Donner directed. The producers offered Donner $1 million, which was a huge sum for Donner, who was making hundreds of thousands of dollars for his films at the time. However, there was a catch to this contract for Donner. He would be directing two films, not just one. But Donner, of course, accepted. Gene Hackman absolutely adored Richard Donner and was very enthusiastic about working with him, and Hackman's hesitancy about paying Lex Luthor really changed after his first meeting with Donner. Now, there was a story where Gene Hackman didn't want to shave his mustache for the role. Donner wasn't pushy, but said that they could revisit the idea once Hackman was going to shoot his scenes. Finally, when the time came, Donner asked Hackman what he thought. Hackman still wanted to keep his mustache, so Donner said, "Tell you what, if you shave yours, I'll shave mine." Hackman agreed, and he shaved off his mustache and came back to set. Hackman then told Donner he had to live up to his end of the bargain, and Donner did. He peeled off his mustache, which was fake. Hackman always loved Donner for that, and the two remained lifelong friends. Now, one thing Hackman would not do was wear a bald skull cap or shave his head, which is why in the film, the hairstyle of Lex Luthor is different in every scene, with Luthor wearing a different wig. And actually, in some ways, this is what makes the film unique, and there is eventually a terrific payoff at the end of the film regarding his lack of hair. Donner then hired writer Tom Mankiewicz to rewrite the initial script, which was an enormous 500 pages. Tom was the son of the classic filmmaker Joseph Mankiewicz. Tom was a well-known script doctor and often was brought into projects to spruce up the script, like he did in a few James Bond films in the late 60s and 70s. Tom was eventually credited as a creative consultant to Donner in the film. Now, the original script was campy. Donner didn't want a parody of Superman. The film didn't need to be all serious, but it couldn't be like Batman in 1966. An example of the early script camp would be Superman running into Telly Savalas, who was playing Kojak at the time, and he'd give his catchphrase, "Who loves you, baby?" This would have immediately dated the film, and Donner wanted to avoid all things like this. What Tom Mankiewicz really brought into the script was the love affair between Superman and Lois Lane, and the relationship with Clark Kent and Lois. And throughout the first two films, this theme was vital to both stories. It was a brilliant move, because it also gave women a chance to love a comic book type film. Also, the beginning scenes on Krypton had almost a biblical tone to them. For example, Jor-El sending his only son to Earth. This was basically the equivalent of sending Christ down from the heavens. Then the scenes where Clark Kent grows up in Smallville had a very Americana feel to it. But the moment that Clark arrives in Metropolis, the film takes a comic strip tone. It was simply brilliant, and again, the blueprint was set by Mankiewicz and Donner. And this is what every other superhero film did after Superman 78. Next, who was going to play Superman and Clark Kent? The producers wanted Robert Redford or Paul Newman, essentially another major star to compete with Brando and Hackman. However, Donner's issue with hiring a major star like Redford or Newman is that the audience wouldn't necessarily buy into these well-known actors as superheroes. Could you really picture Robert Redford flying? No, not at all. And this is why Donner wanted an unknown actor for the role of Superman. And he was totally correct. But this desire for an unknown actor was easier said than done. There would be a number of people that would come in and look the part, but they couldn't act, and vice versa. On the DVD, you can see the screen tests of a number of unknown actors auditioning as Superman, and it's hilarious. And of course, this is why Christopher Reeve was so perfect. He could not only pull off the look and the acting of Superman, but he could be equally convincing as Clark Kent. He was athletic and facially chiseled just like the comics. He also had the vocal chops. In my opinion, no other actor after him ever pulled off both Superman and Clark Kent as well as Christopher Reeve. And while it typecast him for the remainder of his career, he will forever be the perfect Superman. Reeve was savvy enough to realize he didn't need to overact to play the part of Superman. He knew that technology and special effects for the time would be better than anything done before. And to this day, the special effects hold up extremely well. Frankly, I think they're almost better than today's sterile and dark CGI. It's a very bright looking film. Next was to cast Lois Lane, and many actresses tested, like Leslie Ann Warren, Ann Archer, Susan Blakely, Deborah Raffin, and Stalker Channing. But it was Margot Kidder's spirit and charm that really impressed Donner and Mankiewicz. Kidder said her method to the audition was to have the persona that she really loved Superman. And this, again, was a smart move because the essence of the film is a love story. Kidder and Channing were the final two actresses in competition before Kidder was given the role. However, Reeve and Kidder's style of acting were completely different. Reeve was almost a method actor, always staying in character, whereas Kidder was more of a free spirit and liked to joke around. But while they would bicker like siblings on set, they did have an undeniable chemistry that translated on screen. In addition to the new talent, there were a plethora of classic actors that rounded out the cast brilliantly, like Glenn Ford, Jackie Cooper, and Trevor Howard. You also had established actors like Ned Beatty and Terrence Stamp, Valerie Perrine, Jack O'Halloran, and Mark McClure. Now keep in mind that director Guy Hamilton was on the picture for a full year and that $6 million was already spent. And none of what Hamilton had envisioned with Superman was what Richard Donner wanted, so everything had to be scrapped. Time was really running out, and they hadn't even figured out how to make Superman fly convincingly. So John Barry, who was the production designer in Star Wars, was hired to solve this major issue, along with the sets, like Krypton. And cinematographer Jeffrey Unsworth was also vital in his stylistic shots, making the film look second to none. Unsworth's previous work included 2001 A Space Odyssey and Cabaret. And sadly, Unsworth died shortly after the film was completed, and Superman is dedicated to him in the credits. Shooting lasted 19 months, and the budget was the most expensive film in history at this point, as I mentioned. But again, keep in mind that two films were being made, the original and the sequel. The process was grueling on everyone, but especially Donner, who admitted it was sometimes a struggle to keep up the energy. Plus, you'd be toggling back and forth between filming shots of the first and second films. So, to figure out that continuity, for example, shooting scenes at the Daily Planet, was to remember which film it was for. The sets looked the same, but the film and story were completely different. Now, for the Superman costume, there were around 25 different costumes that were used for different types of scenes, whether it be for flying or walking. But again, the color palette was absolutely perfect, and the costume truly looked straight out of the comics. No other Superman version ever looked more brilliant. And equally brilliant was the decision to make Krypton costumes completely unique in bright, reflective white, with the S emblem matted in black. They truly look like they were made from outer space. Now, I mentioned the challenge of making the flying of Superman look convincing. If you've seen the Superman TV show from the 1950s with George Reeves, you know how non-realistic those flying shots looked. Essentially, it was George Reeves laying on a table with a sky background. That would simply not pass for a modern film. So a harness rig was set up to give the flying illusion, but credit also must be given to Christopher Reeve. He truly sells the notion that he's flying. He does it with his body movements and the way he contorts his body, and he changes up the styles depending on the scene. I don't believe enough credit is given to Reeve for his intuitiveness about the flying scenes. But much of these effects were the equivalent of the Wright brothers attempting to fly the first airplane. All these effects were experimental, and they truly hold up incredibly well today. And again, so much better than the ease of CGI. So much manual effort was put into these effects, and the film is better for it. Now, I mentioned the original deal between the producers and Warners earlier. The problem with a negative pickup deal is that if the film goes way over budget, it's the problem of the people making the film, not the studio. And this film went way over budget and schedule. But as it turned out, Warners loved what they saw from the eventual dailies and became more involved. They eventually obtained a greater share of the film to offset the producer's costs, along with the lucrative TV rights and international distribution rights. And these TV rights came into play a few years later, which I will cover. Because the film took so long to make, Richard Donner and the producers would often battle about creative control versus the budget, and Richard Lester was brought in as sort of a failsafe in case Donner quit. But Donner never quit, though the saga of Superman 2 is another story that I will save for that particular episode. The plan of filming two films at once ultimately failed, as there was not enough cash to finance both films. So while a good number of shots were filmed for the sequel, it was decided to put out the first film and worry about the second film when the time came. And frankly, to see if the first film was even successful. Lastly was the score, which ended up yet being another vital piece to the enormous success of Superman. The composer was the great John Williams, fresh off his work on Star Wars, but he also had films to his credit like Fiddler on the Roof, The Poseidon Adventure, The Towering Inferno, Jaws, and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Now look, Williams is arguably the greatest film composer in the history of film, and the score and the theme he wrote for Superman is still one of his greatest compositions. That says a lot. It brings the entire magic of Superman together brilliantly. It even enhances it, which is what great scores do. It's fun, upbeat, and inspiring. The opening credits are goosebump-inducing. It is the perfect theme song. And speaking of the opening credits, the 3D-like lettering of each title and cast members was groundbreaking and visually stunning to watch. It really can't be understated how visually terrific the film was back in 1978. It was like seeing the title flying into the screen. Okay, let's talk a bit about the additions to the Director's Cut DVD from 2000. Now, 8 minutes were included in this 2000 Director's Cut and included an updated soundtrack mix. Now, the reason for the special editions at the time was due to the many of scenes not having the high quality of special effects standards. Donner felt this would harm the film if additional scenes weren't cohesive. Most of the new footage were scene extensions. However, two major additions were included. They were Superman and the Fortress of Solitude. So Superman explains to his father that he used his supernatural powers to help the humans, and Jor-El advises him to keep his supernatural powers a secret to protect his real identity and his family. In addition to that, Superman is told to not overestimate himself because vanity is one of the reasons why Krypton was destroyed. Let's play that clip.
You enjoyed it.
I don't know what to say, Father. I'm afraid I just got carried away.
I anticipated this, my son.
You couldn't have. You couldn't have imagined
how good it felt. You are revealed to the world. Very well. So be it. But you still must keep your secret identity.
Why?
The reasons are two. First, you cannot serve humanity 28 hours a day.
24.
Or 24, as it is in Earth time. Your help would be called for endlessly, even for those tasks which human beings could solve themselves. It is their habit to abuse their resources in such a way.
And secondly?
Second, your enemies will discover their only way to hurt you by hurting the people you care for.
Thank you, Father.
Lastly, do not punish yourself for your feelings of vanity. Simply learn to control them. It is an affliction common to all, even on Krypton. Our destruction could have been avoided but for the vanity of some who consider us indestructible. If it were not for vanity, why? At this very moment, I could embrace you in my arms. My son.
Are coming in of a miraculous saving.
We've
of
had
Air
reports of a burglar being apprehended by an
accident. Yes, I said flying. The aircraft is risking Miss Rose Lane's life on the daily planet with one hand and over the edge when the
cage. Hey, that'll be the day, huh? That'll be the day when a guy can fly, huh?
Oh, I don't know. Be surprised.
Yeah.
Now, the second scene is where Lex Luthor tries to stop Superman by using heavy weapons and fire and ice in his underground bunker before the mass destruction begins using stolen missiles. All of these scenes in this director's cut from 2000 were approved by Richard Donner. Now, even more interesting is there were additions to the TV version. There was almost 40 minutes of additional footage that was added to the two-night television premiere of the film in 1982. However, most of these additions would likely only be noticed by fans of the films that have watched the standard theatrical release many, many times. Some of the additions that stood out for me included in Smallville, where Clark is the ball boy for the football team and his conversation with Lana Lang, who he has a crush on, is much longer than the original film. Otis, played by Ned Beatty, is being tailed by the detectives in the beginning of the film, and that's longer, along with Lex Luthor's hideout scenes where we meet Miss Tessmacher. There's a scene where Luthor, Miss Tessmacher, and Otis attempt to steal the missile, and that's longer, and Luthor attacks Otis after he screwed up the missile code. There's a call with the Pentagon to the president about Luthor stealing a nuclear missile. There's also more destruction in California from the earthquake, like the Hollywood sign collapsing, along with houses in San Francisco. Also, when Superman fixes the dam with broken rocks from the mountains, the much-needed excess dam water flows into the Indian nation to help with their drought, the same Indian tribe that Lois was interviewing before the car becomes crushed by the earthquake. Luthor also sings a song and plays the piano in his lair before Superman apprehends him. Luthor almost feeds Miss Tessmacher to his wild animals for helping Superman with the kryptonite necklace. All in all, the TV extended cut is a lot of fun for huge fans of the original films, but it's not something I would consider as the definitive version of the film. I still think for casual viewing, it's best to watch the original version for its precision and clarity. The extended TV version is fun to watch a few times as an alternative or to show your friends who have never seen it before. You can also buy it on DVD and Blu-ray now. Richard Donner never liked this 3-hour TV version, and he knew it was a cash grab by the producers adding scenes that he felt were inferior and were rightly cut from the original film. But again, if you're interested, go check out the DVD. All right, let's get into the film. So this won't be like a normal episode where I go through the plot and all that fun stuff because, frankly, you probably already know it already. So what I'm going to do is kind of go through some of my favorite scenes and the most notable scenes, and we'll go on from there. Again, Superman is arguably the most important superhero movie ever made because it was the first to be a super successful, no pun intended, film with the enormous budget for the time. It set the blueprint for every other comic book themed film to come out after it. Even the modern Marvel films wouldn't be the same without Superman the movie. So I love the beginning where we see the first issue of Action Comics being read circa June 1938. And then right into the 3D title cards and the perfect John Williams theme score. It's arguably one of the best openings to a film in history. No joke. I'm really envious of the people who were actually able to see this film in the theater when it was first released. I can only imagine the feeling. Of course, in the beginning, you get a tease from the great Terrence Stamp, and most people didn't realize that there was going to be a sequel. You will bow down before me. It's such a great tease for the eventual sequel, but nobody knew at the time. The great Terrence Stamp can be heard here.
Finally, General Zod, once trusted by this council, charged with maintaining the defense of the planet Krypton itself, chief architect of this intended revolution and author of this insidious plot, to establish a new order amongst us, with himself as absolute ruler. You have heard the evidence. The decision of the council will now be heard.
Guilty.
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 The vote must be unanimous, Jor-El. It has therefore now become your decision. You alone will condemn us if you wish, and you alone will be held responsible by me. Join us. You have been known to disagree with the Council before. Yours could become an important voice in the new order, second only to my own. I offer you a chance for greatness, Jor-El. Take it. Join us. You will bow down before me, Jor-El. I swear it. No matter that it takes an eternity, you will bow down before me. Both you and then one day, your heirs.
Now, of course, the ultimate irony of the villain's banishment to the Phantom Zone is that if they had stayed on Krypton, they would have received the fate they deserved. Now, the spaceship created by Jor-El to transport his son to Earth was always so cool looking to me. It was shaped like a star, which eventually evaporates when it gets closer to Earth. And if you think about this film, it's like three films in one. You have Krypton, Smallville, and Metropolis. The scene where the baby lands and grabs the truck when the jack breaks, that's still terrific to watch today. And then Glenn Ford's speech before he dies is still one of the best performances in this film.
Hey, look, there's Clark. Clark?
How'd you get here so fast?
I ran.
Ran, huh? Cool. Told you's an oddball. Let's get out of here.
Been showing off a bit, haven't you, son? I didn't mean to show off, Pa.
Yeah, I know. You can do all these amazing things, and sometimes you think that you will just go bust unless you can tell people about it, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, every time I get the football, I can make a touchdown.
That's for sure.
Every time.
Yeah.
I mean, is it showing off and somebody's doing the things he's capable of doing? Is a bird showing off when it flies?
No. No, now you listen to me. When you first came to us, we thought that people would come and take you away because when they found out, you know, the things you could do, and that worried us a lot. But then a man gets older and he thinks very differently and things get very clear. And there's one thing I do know, son, and that is you are here for a reason. I don't know whose reason, whatever the reason is, you know, maybe it's because but I do know one thing. It's not to score touchdowns. Huh?
Yeah. Thanks, Dad. I race you to it. Yeah.
You will.
Come on. Come on, Pop. Brent, come on. Come on. Move, move. Yeah, go, go, go. Come on, Brent. Hey, Brent. Come on, Brent.
Oh, no.
I love that one of the original Lois Lanes from the TV show, played by Noelle Neal, plays Lois's mom during the train scene where Clark races the train as a teenager. And her father is Kirk Allen, who played the original Superman in the 1940s serials.
Golly! I saw a boy up there run as fast as the train! Faster even!
Lois Lane, you have a writer's gift for invention. I'll say that for you.
But...
Lois... Please read your book.
No one ever believes me.
The creation of the Fortress of Solitude with the green crystal from the original ship was always awesome to see. I also really enjoyed the essence of keeping the early Metropolis scenes basic, meaning Clark was stopping a holdup, and Superman saves a cat, the helicopter scene, or catching a cat burglar, the bank robbers, preventing a plane from crashing, things that I've always enjoyed. Not everything has to be supernatural to be effective. Who could forget the yelling of "Miss Tessmacher!" by Gene Hackman? It's so good.
Miss Tessmacher!
And every time Gene Hackman speaks, it's pure gold. And of course, Ned Beatty is a terrific foil.
Sick. Hey, you're really sick.
Sick, Miss Tessmacher? Sick when I'm mere days from executing the crime of the century?
No.
Step away from that, please. How do you choose to congratulate the greatest criminal mind of our time?
Huh?
Do you tell me that I'm brilliant? Oh, no. That would be too obvious. I grant you. Charismatic. Fiendishly gifted.
Try twisted.
Get away!
Tell me something, Lex. Why do so many people have to die for the crime of the century?
Why? You ask why? Why does the phone always ring when you're in the bathtub? Why is the most brilliantly diabolical leader of our time surrounding himself with total nincompoops?
I'm back, Mr. Luthor!
Yes, I was just talking about you. You're followed again.
It's one of those cat-like reflexes. Mr. Luthor, I'm sorry.
Otis, is that the newspaper I asked you to get me?
Yeah.
Why am I not reading it?
Because I haven't given it to you yet?
Right. Last, it's official.
Thanks to the generous help of the United States government, we are about to be involved in the greatest real estate swindle of all time.
Lex, what is this obsession with real estate? All the time, land.
Miss Tessmacher, when I was 6 years old, my father said to me...
Get out.
Before that, he said, son, stocks may rise and fall. Utilities and transportation systems may collapse. People are no damn good, but they will always need land, and they'll pay through the nose to get it. Remember, my father said,
land.
Right. It's a pity that he didn't see from such humble beginnings how I've created this empire.
An empire? This?
Miss Tessmacher, how many girls do you know who have a Park Avenue address like this one?
Park Avenue address? 200 feet below?
Do you realize what people are shelling out up there for a few miserable rooms off a common elevator?
What more could anyone ask?
Here's an underrated line by Lois, and it still holds true.
I mean, why are you here? There must be a reason for you to be here.
Yes, I'm here to fight for truth and justice in the American way.
You're going to end up fighting every elected official in this country.
Sure you don't really mean that, Lois.
If you didn't know, Larry Hagman is cameoed as the Army Sergeant. And of course, don't ever forget the best city on the West Coast, Otisburg.
Right.
So, problem. How to make the land more valuable between the time you buy it and the time you sell it. Now, this is California, the richest, most populous state in the Union.
I don't need a geography lesson from you, Luthor.
Oh, yes, of course, you've been there. I do forget you. Get around, don't you? Where was I?
California.
California, right. The San Andreas Fault, maybe you've heard of it.
Yes, it's the joining together of two landmasses. The fault line is unstable and shifting, which is why you get earthquakes in California from time to time.
Wonderful. Couldn't have said it better myself. Everything west of this line is the richest, most expensive real estate in the world. San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco. Everything on this side of the line is just hundreds and hundreds of miles of worthless desert land, which just so happens to be owned by...
Lex Luthor Incorporated.
Now, call me... foolish, call me irresponsible. It occurs to me that a 500 megaton bomb planted at just the proper point would
destroy most of California. Millions of innocent people would be killed. The West Coast as we know it would
fall into the sea. Bye-bye, California. Hello, new West Coast, my West Coast. Costa del Ex, Lutherville, Marina del Ex, Otisburg. Otisburg?
Miss Tess Mozart, she's got her own place,
Mr. Otisburg?
It's a little bitty place.
Otisburg?
Okay, I just wipe it off, that's all. It's a little town.
You're a dreamer, Lex Luthor. A sick, twisted dreamer. Your plan couldn't possibly work.
I'll admit there were a few problems. Adjusting the precise trajectory of the missile. Finding the optimum stress point for the fault line itself. Which, by the way, is target zero, right here.
Ooh.
And lastly, the greatest power scream in history. All right, there are a ton of fun facts. So as you likely know, Richard Donner was fired after the success of the original film. He was not brought back to direct the sequel, though many of his scenes and ideas are in the final version of Superman 2. Now, Tom Mankiewicz's theory is that if the original Superman wasn't as successful as it was, the producers would have had to bring back Donner to finish the sequel. But since the film was such a hit, the producers felt they didn't need the contentious relationship to return with Donner. The entire cast and crew were devastated because they all loved working with Richard Donner. What's interesting now is the only version of Superman 2 currently available on Blu-ray is a restored Richard Donner cut, which is really interesting to watch. I will get into Superman 2 at some point. Marlon Brando, as was the case towards the latter portion of his career, had his dialogue printed all over the set for him to read. Anytime he's looking down during a scene, he's reading his lines. He told Richard Donner that the only way to keep his performance fresh and not over-rehearsed was to record the first time he read his lines. Now look, that's a nice theory, but the most of the people that worked with him basically claimed he was simply being lazy. He couldn't be bothered to learn his lines, even at $4 million for a film. And he was only working for 2 weeks. However, Brando, still not satisfied with his huge contract, actually sued the producers claiming he was cheated out of the box office profits. And that's why you don't see him or his character Jor-El in Superman 2. He did actually win the lawsuit. Now, Keenan Wynn was going to be the original Perry White, but he had heart troubles and never actually shot a scene. Jackie Cooper then replaced Wynn immediately and shot his scenes in England the next day. Cooper actually auditioned for the Otis character. Goldie Hawn was the first choice for Miss Tessmacher, but her salary was too high. Next was Anne Margaret, but it was the same issue regarding salary. And ultimately it went to Valerie Perrine, because she was the most affordable, but she was great in the role. Christopher Lee had to turn down the role of General Zod. He had just moved to Hollywood as a tax exile, and he did not want to have to return back to England. James Caan was offered the role of Superman, but said he didn't want to wear the silly suit. Steven Spielberg was offered the film to direct, but his salary was too much at the time for the budget. To obtain the musculature to convincingly play Superman, Christopher Reeve underwent a bodybuilding regime supervised by David Prowse. He was the man who played Darth Vader in the original Star Wars trilogy. For his portrayal of Clark Kent, Christopher Reeve based his performance on Cary Grant's performance in 1938's Bringing Up Baby. Now, after the success of the original Rocky in 1976, Sylvester Stallone lobbied hard to play Clark Kent in Superman, but he was ultimately turned down because he was deemed, quote, too Italian. Stallone found out that Marlon Brando, who had casting approval, turned him down for the role, just as he had allegedly vetoed Burt Reynolds' casting as Sonny in The Godfather. Stallone later explained that he felt it was hypocritical that Brando, who stated on numerous occasions that he took the role of Jor-El simply as a paycheck and nothing more, vetoed him for the role of Superman. To achieve the shot of young Clark Kent kicking a football into orbit, an air cannon was placed underground, and the football was fired from it. Superman was actually nominated for 3 Oscars, but lost out on all of them. It lost for film editing to The Deer Hunter. It lost original score to Midnight Express. Jeez. And it lost sound to The Deer Hunter. However, Superman did win a special achievement award for best visual effects. Just like we did for The Wizard of Oz and the Halloween episode, we're going to have a panel of guests and some set questions for them. First, it's going to be Metal Mike Tyler, then Joseph Staub, then first-time guest Charles Trainer, and then Eric Sinzak. They all answer my questions and give great answers, so hope you look forward to that. Also, speaking of Charles, at the time, he was on the Freeform Rock podcast when I was recording this. Currently, he's no longer on that show, but he is talking about starting his own podcast with Joseph Staub and Travis Parada. So be on the lookout for that. And then I'll be back next week to talk about yet another random movie. from my DVD collection.
All right, we're back with Metal Mike Tyler. Of course, we got to start with him because he is a comic book junkie. And of course, what I believe his favorite superhero is Superman. So welcome back, Metal Mike Tyler.
Superman's up there. He's way up there. But my two favorites is Batman. My favorite DC character is Batman. My favorite Marvel character is Spider-Man. But Superman's way up there. Like, I mean, if Batman beats out Superman, it's by a pubic hair. All right. Okay. Maybe a super pubic hair. Who knows?
Super, yeah, but, that's right. Well, that wasn't one of my questions, but here we go. So, first time you saw the film, was it theater?
Yes, my mom and dad took me in 1970. I believe it was during the holidays because I think Superman came out during Christmas time, if I remember right. And it was kind of funny because before that, I liked Superman. I mean, I used to watch the Adventures of Superman television show. And it was on the same channel that did the repeats of the Batman show in the 1960s Spider-Man cartoon. So I liked Superman, and I knew he was my dad's favorite character. But even as a little guy, I was like, well, he's cool, but that's my dad's hero. Spider-Man is mine. Batman is mine, you know. Because, you know, they were in color and Superman was in black and white. And this was before I actually started reading comic books on a regular basis. So, you know, my dad, he took us and my brother said, man, dude, they're saying this is as good as Star Wars. I'm like,
Wow.
You know, but, you know, at the time, that was the buzz around the film. But I just remember going to the movies and I loved it. And that's when I became a bigger Superman fan than I already was. I was like, when I watched that movie, I just felt like, and since then, it's what got me into reading Superman comics after that. It's what got me, I fell in love with the character after that. Like, it was like, okay, I get why my dad loves Superman. Like, I get why he's his number one. And my dad loves some Batman, too. Don't get it twisted. But, yeah, Superman's his guy, man. And I just think Richard Donner, even though he doesn't really get credit for it, from what I understand, he pretty much rewrote that entire screenplay. Absolutely. I've got some background stuff on the Superman movies, if you want. I got some dirt, dude.
Well, when I wrap up my set questions, I'll have you fired at me. So
yes.
The next question I have for you, if Christopher Reeve isn't your favorite Superman, then who is it?
He's my favorite. You know, but I think Henry Cavill was a great Superman. I kind of feel like he got a bit shortchanged because of all the bungling at Warner Brothers. But I think, George Reeves was great. I think every Superman brought something cool to the character, but Christopher Reeve, he just, in my opinion, he nailed it. And one of the things he did great was not just Superman, but Clark Kent.
Sure.
That part where he's in Lois's apartment as Clark and he takes his glasses off. He's not slumping his shoulders anymore. He changes his voice. Lois, there's something I have to tell you. In his Superman voice. And all of a sudden he has a change of heart. And then he goes right back to being Clark. I mean, what a performance, man. I don't think Christopher Reeve gets enough credit. He brought a lot of heart to that part, you know, because to me, some people think, oh, well, Clark's the fake guy and Superman's the real guy. I disagree. I think there's actually three sides to Superman. You've got Metropolis Clark, which is kind of the bungling, nerdy guy, but sweet. I mean, he's a good guy, but you know how he is. Then you have your Superman persona, which is kind of what he really is. But Smallville Clark is the real Clark. At his core, Superman is a farm boy from Kansas who has these amazing powers and abilities that just wants to do the right thing.
Right.
And I think... Richard Donner nailed it. So that's my take on it.
Yeah. So again, speaking of Richard Donner, and this might be tough for you, but do you prefer the first film or the sequel?
I prefer the first film. Okay. In fact, I prefer his version of Superman 2. Okay. Superman 2, as it was released, was a little campy in parts for my taste.
Sure.
You know, but whenever we do Superman 2, we'll talk about that.
Okay. Later. That's cool. What is your favorite scene in the original Superman, if you can name one?
Ooh,
you might have just said it, actually.
That's one of them, but one of my other favorite parts, because there's some people, like my father, he loves Gene Hackman, but he's like, well, to me, it was Gene Hackman playing Lex Luthor. It wasn't really Lex Luthor. And while I get what my father is saying, and he is not besmirching or anything, he loves Gene Hackman.
Oh, yeah.
But when he's kind of got a point. There's times where Lex in this movie will say these little puns that's not really in character. Lex Luthor is pretty evil and he's just very serious. And there's not much humor in the character, but my favorite part, one of my favorite parts of the movie, and where I feel like he totally nails Luthor, is when he starts talking to Superman in the frequency that only dogs can hear.
Yes.
And he's talking about what he wants to do in a Metropolis and how he's going to do it. And, and I know it seems a bit much, Superman, but I knew you'd never accept an invitation to tea, but life's threatened with people in danger. I just thought that he was brilliant in that part. And I'm like, that's Lex Luthor.
Yeah.
And even my dad agreed. I'm like, Dad, he did try to destroy California. So not evil enough. I don't know, man. But I understood what my dad was trying to say, because he kind of feels like, when it comes to the big screen, Luthor's never really been portrayed totally like he is in the comics.
Sure.
Because Luthor's a badass, not just mentally, but physically. Like, you're talking about a guy who can throw down with Batman. He's nobody's puss. Mm-hmm. And he's the two times I've seen him portrayed like he is closest to the comics, believe it or not, is Smallville. I thought Michael Rosenbaum did a great job as Lex. And then the other version would be the Young Justice animated series on HBO Max. But I love Hackman, and I just love that part where Superman's scouring the city and he finds him. Just that whole scene. And then the part where he's like, where's that detonator? Somewhere in the back of my mind. And he's like, is that how Warp Brain Lex yours gets kicked? Threatening the lives of innocent people threatening the deaths. He's like, no, by causing the deaths of innocent people.
I'm that's
like,
right.
That's Lex, man. So, yeah, I mean, overall, Superman, to me, is almost a flawless movie. I mean, it literally, Kevin Feige, and I don't know how many other people, and for you people out there don't know, that's the guy that runs Marvel Studios, has said they pattern their films after that. Like, it's still the template, the blueprint of how you do a comic book movie and do it right.
That's right. And look, I'd love to live in Otisburg. So, that's, so speaking of that, there's great side characters who, I mean, if it's not Lex and it's not Superman, who's your favorite character in the original film?
I mean, obviously Superman and Lex are up there, but I mean, I love Lois Lane and I thought Margot Kidder did a great job. She's very plucky, Lois has got moxie. She's nobody's pushover, And I one of my other favorite scenes, of course, is the one where he catches her and he goes, easy, miss, I got you. And she's like, you got me. Who's got you? just great dialogue. I mean, now, Otis is a character that was never in the comics. I think eventually, though, he got to be so popular, though, that they incorporated him in the comics. Mr. Luthor, but what's funny about that is people would be surprised. Like, Jimmy Olsen was a character that was not in the comic books. He was on the Superman radio show. He became so popular that they included him in the comics or incorporated him in the comics. Harley Quinn started in the Batman animated series. She wasn't in the comics. That was a whole new character. But, character catches on and it becomes part of the mythology, and they incorporate it in the comic books as well, which is interesting that something that was based on a comic book had characters that weren't in the comic, but they get to be so popular. The cop, Renee Montoya, who's also in Batman animated series, she got to be so popular that she got incorporated into the Batman comics. So that stuff kind of happens all the time. And I think it took a while with with Otis, but I don't think Miss Tessmacher ever showed up in the comics.
No.
Man, Valerie Perrine, what a woman.
Oof. I know. But this, the way that Gene Hackman yells her name is so
priceless. Oh, I know. Well, it's kind of like the predecessor to the Joker Harley Quinn relationship in a way, because there's a little bit of it's uncomfortable with them two sometimes, man.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And so this might be a tough one for you because I'm putting you on the spot, but John Williams did the score for Superman. What's your favorite John Williams score?
Oh, my God. Oh, right? Brian. Jesus.
I know.
He did so many, man. Superman is definitely one of them.
I mean, my God.
In my top five for sure. Raiders of the Lost Ark. Got to throw that on there. Star Wars, of course.
I mean, if you had to choose between Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Superman or Jaws, which one would you pick?
Fuck.
That's hard, isn't it?
I know, dude. You're killing me here.
Got to pick one.
I would have to say Star Wars.
Okay.
Because, That music is just amazing. But like I said, that's not to disparage any of the other ones, because they're all great. Close Encounters is another one that nobody talks about that he did, man. I mean, that guy, John Williams, is the man.
He is. I think he is the most successful composer of all time, hands down.
You know, I mean, he is a modern day Beethoven and Mozart. Oh. He is, you know. And there were some other great ones, too. I mean, Jerry Goldsmith, man. Come on, The Omen. Holy shit.
John Carpenter.
Yeah. John Carpenter, who does his own films, which is awesome.
Yep. So the last question, and instead of the missile destruction of the West Coast, what would be your villainous plan to stop Superman?
Man, that's a good one. You know, I've always felt like my favorite Superman stories were the ones where if you want to hurt Superman, you break his heart.
Mm.
You kind of do what Lex did do in a way, only he was able to stop it. But you not just kill somebody he cares about, but the one thing Superman does, he cares about people, and he doesn't want to see, you know, I mean, it's like the guys that are doing the new DCU, James Gunn and Peter Safran said, he's kind in a world that believes that kindness is old fashioned.
Mm.
And I think if you want to hurt Superman, that's how you do it. So, there's a great story called Superman for All Seasons, where he fails to save this little girl. And Luthor, of course, orchestrated the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Superman's just laying there broken, just broken, because he failed.
Mm.
And to me, that's how you know. So something along those lines, because I remember the story. He gives this girl these powers, and then ODs on him.
Mm.
And then, you know, and Luthor's like, yeah, you failed. You didn't save her. Big guy, what's up with that? I mean, just, you know, being a total dick like he is. Right. And
It's more mind games than anything.
Yes. But that's Luthor, man. That's what Luthor does. He lives for that shit.
Yep.
I mean, you're talking about one of the smartest people in the DC universe. I mean, he's right up there with Ozymandias and Watchmen. Luthor's only 10 steps ahead of everybody else.
Yeah.
That's how I would do it. Yeah.
That's a good one. As always, you deliver, Metal Mike. Thank you so much, brother.
I appreciate it, man. You rule.
We're back with Joseph Staub. Welcome back.
Thanks again for having me, Brian. It's always great to talk about movies with you.
Awesome. And so we kind of did something a little bit similar with The Wizard of Oz and the Halloween, where we had kind of an ensemble type group for this. And I thought you were perfect for Superman and Superman 1978. So let's go through the questions. So the first one is, when is the first time you actually saw the film? Now, obviously, you're too young. You were born far after 1978. But so when did you actually see the film for the first time?
So as a sad, pathetic Gen Zer, I was introduced to Superman through the extremely, extremely dire 2006 film, Superman Returns.
Oh, wow.
And for some reason, I saw that horrible movie and said, hey, I'd like to go back and watch more Superman movies. Now, why I would ever say that after watching a horrendous film like Superman Returns, I'll never know. But that's what I did, and I went back and I watched the first two movies, and that was right when the Richard Donner cut had just come out of Superman 2, and I watched that as well. So it was right around that time. I would have probably been 8 or 9 years old, and that was what would have been the first time I watched the first Superman movie.
So this is really interesting, and you might be the only one to have this experience, because one of the major criticisms of Superman Returns, and there's many, is that it's basically a copycat of Superman 78.
Yeah, yeah, and I can definitely see that. So, yeah, it was done far worse.
Yeah, definitely. So if Christopher Reeve isn't your favorite Superman, who is?
It's Christopher Reeve. I mean, He's the best. I do have a soft spot for George Reeves in the
'50s
series, mainly just because I'm a huge fan of I Love Lucy, and then of his appearance in I Love Lucy. That's how I was introduced to his performance as Superman. But I have a soft spot for that, as well as a lot of the animated Supermans as well. But Christopher Reeve is definitely the bar as far as Superman goes.
Well, actually, and then the voice of Bud Collier, going all the way back to the radio show, and then, of course, the animated, great voice.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you prefer the first film or the sequel?
So I do prefer the first film only because a perfect cut of Superman 2 doesn't exist.
Mm.
There are things that if you combined the theatrical and Donner cuts of Superman 2, I think it would be the better film. But because that doesn't exist, I would have to say the first film would be my personal favorite. I do definitely have my criticisms of it, and we'll get to those one of the later questions.
Sure.
But I do, of the two, I would prefer the first one just because a perfect cut of the second film doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's totally fair. It's such a shame because we'll never know what really could happen, even though they tried. But yeah. Okay, so what is your favorite scene in the film, in the original film?
So this also kind of betrays my answer to the next question.
Okay.
My favorite scene in this film is when Lex Luthor is explaining his plan to Superman, mm-hmm. and you get the amazing moment of Otisburg.
Yes.
That just that one little moment is my favorite part of this movie. Just, and that kind of betrays, we'll go into the next question, but my favorite character in this movie is Otis. And it kind of goes back and forth a little bit between Lex Luthor and Otis because they work so well together as like a very old-fashioned comedic pairing. And exactly. You can tell the whole time that Lex Luthor is just over his shit the entire time. And it's two phenomenal actors. And you just getting Gene Hackman and Ned Beatty in there next to each other playing those roles is just it's amazing. And it provides a lot of welcome comedy in this movie that kind of ended up going a little bit overboard in Superman 2.
Agreed. And then eventually way overboard in 3.
We don't even talk about those movies.
Right. We'll have to because I do own them, but yes.
Shit.
I'm a completist, but the vocal tone of Gene Hackman when he starts to, you know, the slow build with Otisburg and then just keeps going. So it's brilliant. It's brilliant acting. So obviously one of the best scores is the Superman score, of course, done by John Williams. This might be kind of a Sophie's choice, but what is your favorite John Williams score?
Well, I went back and forth with about 10 movies over the course of trying to answer this question, but I think there is only one true answer to this question, and it's Jaws.
That's fair.
I really think that Jaws is the ultimate movie score.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, you have the amazing moments of tension in that score, but also the really fun adventure music when they're on the Orca going after the shark. And mm-hmm. it's one of my favorite film scores in general. I mean, probably 7 or 8 out of my 10 favorite film scores are John Williams scores.
Right.
But that would probably be my favorite John Williams score.
It really is impossible. I mean, I can't think of a more prolific, composer of film than John Williams. So the final question is, instead of the missile destruction of the West Coast of the United States, which is the main plot for Lex Luthor, what would be your villainous plan to stop Superman?
So I went about this question a little bit differently.
Sure.
Definitely would not be able to think of any kind of villainous plan. Like, it's way out of my realm of thinking, but I just wanted to take a little bit to talk about the plan itself and how great of a villain plan it is, because it's a plan that like literally just doesn't involve Superman whatsoever. And Superman just happens to end up involved in it. And Lex Luthor still has like that security measure of the kryptonite in the box,
mm-hmm.
and like uses that. And if it weren't Hackensack, New Jersey,
Miss Tessmacher,
and her mother living in Hackensack, New Jersey,
right.
He would have gotten away with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that the plot is brilliant, and it's so just the fact that Lex Luthor is so nonchalant about it, and it's just like. Real estate. That's literally this whole thing is just real estate.
Yep.
He's going to kill millions of people just so he can be rich and own the best real estate in the country. And I mean, it's kind of like an ingenious plan just to be able to just be like, okay, so I'm going to basically nuke the fault line and send one of the most populous states in the country into the Pacific Ocean. And then everybody's going to pay me for this fabulous real estate. They're not going to be mad that I just killed millions of people. They're just going to pay me lots of money. But I think it's an amazing plot. And this is where my really big criticism of the movie comes in, Okay. And that's the ending.
Mm.
And that's a lot of people's big criticism with the movie, and especially of the Richard Donner cut of Part 2.
Sure.
Is the ending of Superman flying left to right or whatever to reverse time, and just how stupid that kind of is. And it just it undermines what is such a great plot of the movie, and it just makes it completely removes the stakes of any this and any Superman movie. That if Superman can do that, then what's the point?
Right, because you should use that every time.
Like, okay, literally someone, like, World War III, Russia nukes, Russia and U.S. get into a big nuclear war, Superman just flies around the world a couple hundred times, and boom, we just sit down and talk peace again, and if it happens again, he just keeps doing it until we get it right. So it's like, it literally removes any stakes from any Superman anything, that if that is an ability that he has, then there's literally no consequences to anything. Anybody can do anything bad. He could do anything bad. I mean, people have made jokes about that he, like, in Superman Returns, if he finds out that he has a kid with Lois, he could have flown around the world a couple hundred times. It's free plan B. It's
right,
like,
exactly. It's the best contraceptive there is.
It's the best contraceptive there is. And that's what makes me mad a little bit about it, is that it's such a great plot, a great villain plot. And then in the second film as well, there's some great stakes in that.
And then he gets
his powers back and then flies, especially in the Richard Donner cut, where they literally copy the same ending, which according to Richard Donner, that was originally the ending for the second film, and they just copied and pasted it onto the first movie.
Right.
Any main character could die, and he just flies around the world. It removes all the stakes and all the tension from the movie, and it's just, it feels like everything was just like, okay, what was that all for then?
See, this is why I had you on, Joseph, because this is completely valid. And but again, we wouldn't have had the amazing Christopher Reeve scream without that either. But
that's true. Yes, I mean, you get some great performances out of it. But other than that, I think it just it kind of undermines a lot of the tension and the stakes of the movie.
Oh, I totally agree. Well, we're going to talk about yet another superhero movie soon. So thank you again for doing this, Joseph.
Yep. Thanks for having me, as always, Brian.
Okay, we're back, and we're with a first-time guest, which I always love, and it's Charles Trainer from the Freeform Rock podcast, which, of course, you can hear with Mark Alden Taylor and Jerry Soup, and he's also part of the terrific group of fans who follow the Rock and Metal Combat podcast, and I got to meet Charles at the excellent Rock Pod Expo in Nashville earlier this year, so it's great to have you on, Charles.
Well, thanks for having me, and also on the Mark and Jerry with Charles BS sessions on YouTube, typically on Thursday nights.
That's right. You can't forget that. So you're all over now, and this is great, because it just seemed like a year ago you weren't doing podcasts, but now you're all over the podcast scene now.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's been a ride, that's for sure. I came out of nowhere, I guess, but
which is good.
I've been listening for quite a long time. So
kind of like landing from Krypton onto Earth, and all of a sudden you're a sensation, right? Yeah. So let's get into this. So what I've been doing with everyone is I have a list of set questions, and I'm getting everyone's take on that. So it's kind of a nice ensemble piece. So the first question I've been asking people is, when is the first time you saw the film? What was it in the theater when it first came out?
It actually was. But I was rather young. I looked at the stats today, and it came out like in December of 78.
Yes.
I don't think I saw it in December, but I think it was in the theater a little minute, but I remember seeing it in the theater with my aunt. And I don't think it was the first movie I ever saw in the theater, but it was definitely the first one I remember being excited to go see. And I remember being happy after I left the theater.
So I'm assuming you saw did you see Star Wars in the theater?
No, I did not. Believe it or not, I saw Empire was the first one I seen in the theater.
Okay, so that's interesting, because for, I think, many kids probably around your age, like, those are the big memories, whether it be Jaws, Star Wars, Superman. So Superman was kind of like the big one for you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I wanted to see Star Wars, but for some reason couldn't find anybody to take me. I was still kind of young at the time, but Empire, I definitely saw Empire. I saw Star Wars, I think, on the second run
okay.
in the theater. It was relaunched.
yeah, kids don't know how good they have it now. Where basically it's on your TV almost instantly after something is released. Back then, you really had to go to the theater or you missed it. So when you first saw it, was it, were you just kind of blown away, or was everything like new and exciting to you since you were so young?
Oh, I mean, I was in heaven because I was a super comic book nerd, man. I mean, I had all those. I think it was Mego was the company, and they made like every. They didn't separate the comic book characters. They would have Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, whatever. I had the action figures you could get. I was into all that stuff and anything that had anything to do with superheroes. So to see this on the big screen, it blew my mind, dude. Totally.
Did you have those book and record sets? I think they were called Power Records because a lot of people got into those. Yeah.
I was telling a fan of the show, a little younger than us, or younger me, that I probably had more of those than actual audio records at that time. Because, I mean, I was 4 or 5, whatever. I had all of them, man. And they put them out like every movie, it seemed. So, yeah, I had a bunch of those, man.
Yeah, that would be nice to keep. Those were a lot of fun. All right, so if Christopher Reeve isn't your favorite Superman, who is then?
Well, no, it's Christopher Reeve all the way. That's my Superman. So
what about him does it for you compared to, you know, the other types of Superman?
I think he had a really good balance of the humor involved. And I think he especially with Clark, he played a really good Clark. And I don't know. He just looks like Superman to me. He always did. And maybe some of it's just, you know, age and. That's what I'm used to, but he's a Superman to me. I think they nailed it with the casting of Christopher Reeve.
Yeah, definitely. Do you prefer the first film or the sequel that came out in 1980?
Believe it or not, I actually prefer the sequel. Maybe it's because I remember it a little more. I saw it on my birthday that year. That one was out in the spring. And I liked it more because I think they utilized Superman's powers more in that movie. You got the heat vision, you got the freeze breath, you got a little bit of everything in that. And I love how they tied the first movie in with the sequel, actually. So, and it could be because initially I definitely remember that more from the initial watching because I was young when I saw Superman in the theater. So by a hair, I prefer the sequel.
Did you ever see the later released Richard Donner cut, which was supposed to be the original sequel?
I owned it, so yeah. Okay.
How do you feel compared to what the normal theatrical version with Richard Lester?
I kind of preferred the original cut, really. I was happy with it. It was fun to watch as an artifact, and it did kind of change it a little bit, but not to me it wasn't enough to... Not per the legend of it. I thought the legend of it was more like it was blown up more than what it should have been. I thought the original version was fine.
Okay. Now, what is your favorite scene in the original film?
I know it's probably going to sound crazy, but it's when Larry Hagman checks Miss Tessmacher on the ground there. And then it's like, then he goes about face. You know, I love that part. I laugh at that part to this day. I don't know why, but that part resonates with me. It's hilarious.
Mouth to mouth. And of course, you are a military guy. So I think that
utilize it.
That's great. Nobody's picked that one yet. So that's a great call out because I think people forget Larry Hagman's actually in that. So what is your favorite character in the original film?
Lex Luthor. And I think Gene Hackman nailed it. I thought he was phenomenal in the film.
Yeah, I don't think it would have been tricky to think, you know, of anyone else playing Lex Luthor but Gene Hackman. And if you think back at Gene Hackman, usually he doesn't play good guys. He's almost always the villain in most of his movies.
Yeah. But he did a great job as Lex Luthor, I think. So always enjoyed him.
And really at that point, the two major stars in the original film were actually Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman. The Christopher Reeve wasn't even a star yet.
I don't know that I was as floored by Brando in the film. He was okay. But I think I've enjoyed him in other films. But I just thought Hackman nailed it. I mean, Kevin Spacey basically imitated that in Superman Returns. So
yeah, one of, one of the big knocks on Superman Returns is it's essentially a copy of the original film. It was kind of pointless.
Right, right.
So we're going to get into the score, which is absolutely iconic. That gets thrown around a lot, that term iconic, but it really is. And, of course, John Williams did the score for it. This might be an impossible task for you, but what is your favorite John Williams score? I mean, there's so many of them.
Oh, by far, Star Wars. Yeah, by far. But this one is underrated, man. I mean, this one's up there to me. Indiana Jones was phenomenal, too, but... this one's pretty good. I would put this third, though. I mean, Star Wars, come on, man. You hear that opening thing, it's over. I mean, you know it. Johnny Williams is my favorite film composer, period. So, and it was great. It was awesome. It adds to the epicness. I don't even know if that's a word. Sounds good. But
it definitely is.
Yeah, it sounds cool. It works for this film as well. So this was... I'd put it below Indiana Jones and Star Wars.
Yeah, when you hear that theme come in, especially in the beginning and the way they did the tiling of the font of the letters, I mean, the hair just stands up in your arms. It's still to this day one of the best.
Yeah, totally.
So to wrap up, I mean, instead of, you know, Lex Luthor's plan was a missile destruction of the west coast of the United States, which was a brilliant plan because these missiles are going in opposite directions. So if you were tasked with trying to stop Superman, what would be your villainous plan?
This was the hardest thing to come up with, dude, because I think the storyline is great. But I don't know, man. Maybe Luthor could have figured out the Phantom Zone thing and... unleash Zod and the crew in this film and then use a different story in the sequel. But man, like I said, I think the storyline was so good, and I love how the sequel worked with it. So it's a tough one, but again, maybe unleash Zod in this film and then utilize the character Brainiac. For some reason, he never gets used in any of the films. The animated series is the only time I ever seen Brainiac used properly, I think.
Hmm.
Because he misled Zor-El and then followed Kal-El to Earth. And I think that was a great idea. But other than that, I mean, it was a damn good storyline, man. So it was hard one to maybe unleash Zod first.
Yeah, and that's great. And it's funny because Joseph Staub kind of mentioned the same thing. Because I guess Richard Donner originally had a plan of doing like four films, which would have had Brainiac and other members that would be the foes of Superman. And it just never played out because, of course, Richard Donner was pulled off the film in the second film. And then it kind of trailed off after that because, of course, you have Superman 3 with Richard Pryor and then the fourth one, which is complete garbage. So, yeah, I mean, are there any final thoughts you have about the original film? And is there anything you would have changed, or is it pretty much, you know, when you watch it today, do the memories still come back positive for you?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I remember even watching it on TV, like regular TV, when it came out. It was on ABC back in the day, and they would split it into two parts. And it's an iconic film of my youth. I mean, there's not much I would change. And like I said, I really enjoyed how they tied the original with the sequel, which is something that isn't always easy to do. And it was great. It's an iconic film of my youth, so... that's my Superman. I don't know about Lois Lane in the film. I think maybe there was better Lois Lanes down the road. But overall, I still appreciate the film for what it is. And it was, like I said, I seen it in the theater. So that was pretty cool.
So I'm assuming you prefer Miss Tessmacher over Lois Lane at this point.
Oh, yeah.
The great Valerie Perrine. Yep.
Awesome. It was, well, and Ned Beatty was great,
too. Oh, yes. As Otis, and again, you can't forget Otisburg. So
yeah, it's great. I love it, man. This is my Superman. Now I know for younger folks, they seem to be Henry Cavill, and that's fine. But this was my version that I appreciated the most.
Oh, absolutely, and mine too. And I hope more people keep going back to this one, because I don't think the special effects hold up great today. I mean, he really does look like he's flying, and it obviously isn't CGI. So,
yeah.
Well, thank you for doing this, Charles. And I know we're going to be talking real soon.
Cool. Thanks for having me, dude.
Okay, we're back with Eric Senzak, who, of course, is a longtime guest and also a big fan of superhero movies. So it was a no-brainer to have him on for Superman 1978. So welcome back, Eric.
Yes, thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me back on.
No problem. So, again, we're asking all these different guests the same questions, and we're getting all sorts of different answers, which is a lot of fun. So the first one I've been asking everybody is, can you remember the first time you actually saw the original Superman film from 78?
Yeah, actually, I can. Parents took me to the theater. I think it was a rescreening, and I think it was like a Saturday rescreening they had for kids. Like my mom... I think we all, like, a bunch of kids got together, and I think they took us, I think it's what it was. Mm-hmm. And it was like a Saturday afternoon kind of thing, and they showed it in one of the local theaters in Georgia. Mm. So I think it's when it was, but I definitely remember seeing it on a screen mm-hmm. when I was a kid in the early 80s. So, but it was, definitely watched it several times, like in the house. Mm-hmm. Like seeing it over and over again, like on cable.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
But I have this vivid memory of seeing it up on the screen, like when I was a kid. So, but I think they showed it. You know, of course, I remember when it was released, and then you know we didn't see it when it came out because we were a little too young. I think 78. Sure. We weren't. I mean, my first memory of seeing a movie was in 77 in a drive-in, like in Georgia when Star Wars came out. But I think mm-hmm. we really didn't go to the movies that much when we were kids. But I think in like 82 they did I think they brought it back or something, like in a limited run in theaters, like for Saturday afternoon thing or something like that. We went to the theater and saw it. But I do remember watching it on cable a lot.
That sort of makes sense if it was 1980, because right when the sequel was released too. So maybe that was the reason.
That could be. I think so. Because I do remember going to the movies to see the sequel, because there was a lot of buzz about, you know, the three villains and everything. So
absolutely. So did your parents enjoy the original Superman as much as you guys did?
Oh yeah. Cause my parents, my dad was a huge Brando fan and, you know, cause it was like, you know, they really liked, you know, the classic actors and I think they really enjoyed it a lot. And my mom really liked Christopher Reeve.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's funny.
I think she really, really had a thing for Christopher Reeve.
So. I think everyone did. And then that leads me to the next question. If Christopher Reeve isn't your favorite Superman, do you have a favorite, Superman?
I think Christopher Reeve is probably my favorite Superman, but I think Henry Cavill is pretty close.
Okay. Yeah. 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 He's really good. Do you prefer the first film or the sequel?
I actually like the first film. Just because of the innocence of the first film, it's got so much great introduction to the character, and there's so much. I think the action's great, and I think Gene Hackman is tremendous in the first film as a villain, but he's such a lovable villain, and you know, it's just so much fun. I think the first film didn't delve into the darker depths, darker territories, you know, it's a sweet film, and that's why I enjoy it much more.
Sure. Sure. If you can name one, what is your favorite scene in the original film?
I think my favorite scene is probably gotta be the helicopter scene where he's saving her, mm-hmm. lifting the helicopter up and putting it down.
Yeah.
And just everybody in the street looking up and pointing up, and just, you know, that's kind of where he cements his image to the world right there. It's kind of like, you know, oh God, look at this guy. You know, it's pretty the sort of the chills that he delivers, you know, that right then everybody sees it. It's sort of like that's really sort of cementing the superhero image in everybody's mind right then.
Right. And it's iconic. It's right in front of the Daily Planet. She has the famous line, like, you got me, who's got you? You know,
that, right.
That's perfect. Yep. What is your favorite character in the original film?
Well, you know, it's easy to say I like Superman the best,
sure.
But you know, there's so many, there's so many, you know, identifiable characters. You can like Jimmy cause he's so easy sure. to like the everyman that we can all be like the observer. You can say that Otis would be, oh. you know, funny okay. to be, you could say I like Otis just because of the comedic relief.
Uh-huh.
And there, you can, you know, it's easy to like these characters. It's easy to enjoy seeing that world that they live in. But I gotta say, if I'm going to pick one, honestly, it's kind of strange to say it, but I like Jimmy.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because Jimmy's really, he's sort of an underrated character, I think, you know, and he's sort of the guy that's. He never really stands out in a lot of stuff, but if it was me caught in all these situations, it would be me running around just trying to scramble around looking to see as much as I could. I would be Jimmy. It would be me.
Well, especially at the dam, or the Hoover Dam, and then he kind of gets angry at the end where he's like, yeah, you just let me stand around, Superman, thanks a lot.
You know? Yeah, it's like, I'm stuck. Yeah.
No, and he's great too, and he also appears, he's the only character in the original Christopher Reeve Superman film to appear in Supergirl.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I never even realize that. You're right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
He crosses over to that other, you know, to the other part of the franchise. Yeah, you're
right. That's
right.
Yeah. Okay. So favorite, and this kind of, it's correlated, but I'm going to go outside of Superman here. What is your favorite? And this is hard. John Williams score.
Ooh. You know, it's easy to pick Star Wars.
Sure.
Cause John Williams, you know, he's done so much, with Star Wars, but, you know, I gotta say, man, that's a tough one.
Yeah. That's why I asked it.
Wow. He's done a lot. And it's funny you say that because I've just recently listened to a lot of soundtrack stuff. I've been pulling up Vangelis and I've been pulling up a lot of James Horner and Hans Zimmer. Gosh. Yeah, I don't know. I'm gonna opt out here. I'm gonna go with the easy answer. I'm gonna say Star Wars.
Star Wars.
But yeah, because I can't think of anything else at the moment right now. But it's tons of stuff that Williams has done. I gotta say, well, Close Encounters. I mean, So there's some epics, a lot of epic stuff in Close Encounters. Some good heart pounding stuff there. Yeah, I mean, it's easy to say Star Wars, but, you know, there's so much. You could really just scroll through his catalog and just pull out a lot. So,
well, I think he's easily the most prolific composer of any film or any, you know, movies in general. Like, I mean, my God, I mean, Jaws alone is enough. Probably.
Yeah.
But you said Star Wars, obviously Superman, Indiana Jones. I mean, E.T. too. So it really, really is amazing.
Just in the last few scenes of E.T. alone, if you start pulling out that, just that uplifting, that building track in E.T. where, you know, when he's leaving, I don't know anybody who wasn't a kid at that age watching E.T., that didn't sit there in the theater, gut wrenched and just weeping when E.T. was leaving. I mean, and the music completely just lent itself and made those scenes. I mean, I cried when E.T. left. I mean, of course, everybody did.
You had to. And you're absolutely right. Music makes the difference. And there were so many scenes in Superman where John Williams' score just kind of accentuates that.
Yes. I mean, it's, you know, Even the scenes when he was sitting quietly and he was angry and she had passed and, you know, he thought she was dead and he was holding her, you know, and the score goes down and then there's a huge echo, you know, that's all musical, you know, that all that. And then the echoes of him going around and around and around the world, you know, that dark building sound, that music that's going, you know. People discount a lot of that, but that score, without all that brooding tones and everything like that, you wouldn't get the emotion and it wouldn't resonate with the character through all that. So
not at all. Not at all. And actually, this wasn't a question I had planned, but you brought it up and I think it's worth asking. Some people are upset about that ending because, you know, Superman's not supposed to interfere with history at all. Did that bother you at all? Or was it, you know what, it's part of the film and it is what it is.
No, I think I've never been upset with that ending. I consider that canon. Now that's a canon event. I've never been upset with the ending on that. I grew up with that ending and I don't think there's nothing wrong with it. I see nothing wrong with it.
Okay. Okay. So the final question is, you know, instead of the missile destruction of the West Coast of the United States, what would be your villainous plan to stop Superman if you're Lex Luthor or a supervillain?
I would say directing an asteroid.
Mm.
I would say some kind of a space weapon. Something. Okay. Yeah, I would have some kind of a definite, you know, I'd be sort of a, you know, I'd figure out some kind of a way to direct some kind of an asteroid into a target. And I think that would be some way to do it. Something that he would have to get him away from Earth to go do something. And I figured, you know, if I figured out enough that the sun is, you know, powering him, you know, kryptonite is his, you know, or if the sun is giving him power, I'd figure out a way to get him far away from the sun to get him weak.
Which ironically is what they did in the worst Superman movie is four.
Exactly. The Quest for Peace. Yeah.
So they had the story there. They just obviously couldn't pull it off.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is the one where he's, that's the one where he's, they got the meme where he's drinking. That the one?
That's the
third one. Yeah. Richard Pryor. Yeah. I can never remember which one it was, but I love that shot where he's sitting there with a bottle of liquor. Yeah.
It's definitely inferior to the first two, but I still have kind of nostalgia for it. It's kind of maybe not a good comparison. It's kind of like Rocky III. Rocky III is so much fun, but I realize it's not as good as the first two, but it's still a lot of fun. I kind of feel that way about three.
Yeah, three. For some reason, three in the trilogy always has sort of a but it's still good.
right, exactly. And you're using Richard Pryor, who at the time was one of the top comedians. So
I still don't know how his casting came about, but I guess it works. You know, I would love to figure out who was in that meeting and how that meeting, I mean, I wonder what that meeting was like. I it's the 80s and there was drugs involved, but you know, I'm sure there was some drugs and
the fun part about that movie, I think, is the computer hacking, especially today.
Yeah, that was interesting because, I mean, and also the idea that the computer was sort of AI, sort of sentient and becoming sentient. And it is a little bit of a future commentary on what's going on now. So
absolutely. So maybe it was a little bit ahead of its time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're a little with sort of the things we're fearing coming to fruition that maybe, you know, but I mean, if you could. I don't know. I don't think you could remake it, but it has tones that people fear. I mean, it was before Terminator.
Yep.
So, I mean, it wasn't before Terminator. It was after.
No, it was before. I think it came out in 83. So.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Yeah. So it was before Terminator. So, yeah, I guess. Maybe I guess it was ahead of its time. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. There's this great podcast called Stuck in the 80s, and they were basically kind of saying how the 80s had a lot of these kind of future AI movies, one of them being War Games, and then also, you know, Tron and things like that. So, I mean, it's not like this hasn't been, you know, talked about before, you know, with AI.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Well, as always, thank you so much for doing this, Eric, and I know you're going to be on another superhero movie pretty soon.
Oh, yeah, I hope so. Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Eric.
If you enjoy this podcast and are an iTunes user, please do the show a favor and head on over to the official iTunes page for Damn Good Movie Memories. Be sure to leave a rating and a review. This will allow the show to appear higher in the algorithm and spread the joy of this podcast to the masses. If you are not an iTunes user, you can still listen and subscribe on Podbean at damngoodmoviememories.podbean.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook under our Damn Good Movie Memories page. You can also listen to a limited number of episodes on YouTube. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode, and be sure to tune in next week for an all-new episode of Damn Good Movie Memories.